All right. Good evening. Thanks for joining. Guten Chodesh. Guten Chodesh. Gabenst Chodesh. Aziz Chodesh for everyone. A Chodesh of Mazel and Bracha and healing. Chodesh Iyar is a month of healing. May it be Ani Hashem Reifecha for the world, for all the whatever needs healing in this world should be healed, and ultimately the Golos, the Shechina is called ill during the exile. So we bench the Eibishter that the Eibishter should have the Shechina should have a refuah shalema in Chodesh Iyar. The Golos should be removed, and there should be already a healing, a cosmic healing in all of creation. I'm proud to present a new series over here at Mayon for Sfiras Omer, Sfiras Self-Accounting, given over by Rabbi Mendel Zirkin, my son-in-law. I'm not going to say anything much about him. I'm just going to say that I'm proud of my daughter that she was able to teach him so much about marriage in such a short time. I wonder where she saw how to be married. It must have been from me. So whatever you're learning now, that's what it is. It's unbelievable. Okay, without further ado, Rabbi Zirkin, Chesed, dangerous love. Let's find out how to handle it.
So you have by the tables, we printed out an outline of today's class. And it's probably appropriate to mention that the discussion about relationships, so there's two interesting, significant parts to this, is that number one, my wife actually put this together, typing it up for me, and the very fact that I was able to put it on a piece of paper, there's a certain sense of that, how far marriage has affected me, that we mitzamsim the seichel or ideas into something that could be organized and structured on a piece of paper. Just a few very general introductory words. Nothing that I'm going to be saying, I think, is of any chiddush, of something which people do not know. Most people, whether you're in a relationship now, whether it's a relationship between a marriage relationship or a relationship of children, and we're all in a relationship on some level, and as we're going to connect this obviously to a relationship between us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, there's certain natural understandings, there's certain instinctive and intuitive understandings that we all have about relationships, the struggles with the relationships, and even certain basic tips or perspectives that we should have. So as the Ramchal writes in his introduction to Mesilas Yesharim, he says, I'm not telling you anything new over here. All I'm just is reiterating that which you already know, but in a more structured way, in a way that if you listen and read it, you should be able to penetrate into yourself and make it part of you. So the hope and the objective of this class is not to blow you away with new chidushim, but to maybe bring out the ideas in a very a very strong way. A lot of times we know certain things, but until we hear them, until we actually hear them said, or we say them ourselves, we don't necessarily fully appreciate them. So that's what hopefully we'll try to accomplish in the time that we just have this class. Another point, whatever I am going to say, whatever I have written down over here, is coming from, obviously, some extent experience, study, experience myself, experience dealing with other people, and a lot of thinking. And most of what's here, like I said, I don't think it's chidushim, but it's not. This is, I think, things that most thinking people come up with. and things that people would understand. And the phrases or the quotes, most of them are mine. If you like to disagree with them, you're more than welcome.
Before you actually start, I do want to thank someone who is a sponsor of tonight, Brian and Amy Brooker. So this should be a big schuss for them and all that they need. Just a lot of mazel and good things. Thank you.
Okay. So why are we having this class? So that seems to be quite obvious. We're dealing with the time period of Sphira. Sphira is the time period from Pesach till Shavuos. We know when the Eden left Mitzrayim, so they counted the 49 days from when they left till they received the Torah. During those 49 days, it's explained that there was a certain soul-searching and soul-refining process that took place. And this is what we count, and we're not just counting the days, but as the idea is that we're going through the similar process of refining ourselves. The focus is primarily on the emotions, on the midos. When we say the sphira, when we count the night sphira, so we say at the end, we say a particular mida. We mention either chesed, sheba chesed, and so on and so forth. We mention a certain mida related to that particular day. Each one of the 49 days has within it a certain mida. A way we could conceptualize what we're trying to do, what we're trying to accomplish, is overcoming our created self and coming in tune with our more natural, instinctual, our more essential self. What does that mean? That means is that we all identify ourselves as something. The nature of human beings is that we are forced to identify ourselves. We can't just walk around the whole day and have no place in our minds of how to identify ourselves to ourselves. We give ourselves a lot of labels. We give ourselves a lot of titles. Some of them are thought out well, or they're actually correct. Some are wishes that we wish we were, or some are what other people have given, chosen for us. But there's a necessity of man, or in our conscious mind, there's a necessity to give ourselves a certain identity. But that very nature of giving ourselves an identity has already limited us. The very fact that we define ourselves as a something is already a certain limitation. And therefore, the more we start identifying ourselves, the more we remove ourselves from our true essence, from our true being. The process of Pesach and its continuation into the Sfira days, Teshuas, is the redirecting of how we view ourselves. We all have an identity, but what is the true identity? Is my identity my self-egotistical created identity? Is it an identity that I chose based on necessity, based on what I would like to be, as we said, or for any other reason? Is it a true identity, or is it a limited identity based on my conscious awareness of myself? Pesach represents the idea of refraining from chometz. What does chometz represent? Chometz represents ego. This is an idea that's expressed in Kabbalah, and the Kli Yoker explains it very beautifully, and Chassidus has many, many discussions on this point, that the idea of chometz represents the idea of ego. Pesach, we're refraining from the ego. Why? Because the ego is a bad thing. What does it mean an ego is a bad thing? An ego is a self-created identity. It's a self-created image that we made for ourselves, and it's a very limiting image that we created for ourselves. So just like when we want to refrain, or when we want to change a certain habit that we have to first zoom away from it. Person is addicted to alcohol, so the first stages are to remove themselves from the alcohol, so they become more objective, they become more aware. So to Pesach, for the first 6-7 days, we remove ourselves from the ego, from the negative relationship to the ego. Then, starting with Shri Shal Pesach, Achrin Shal Pesach, that's why we're a little bit more lenient, especially in the Chabad circles about Gebrochs and things like that. And culminates into Shavuos when the mitzvah, the obligation is to bring chametz. One of the only times in the Torah, the only times that you brought in the Beis HaMikdash actual chametz as a korban was on Shavuos. Because what you're doing is you're transforming this identity this I, this ego into an I. In other words, it's no more a self-created identity. It's no more something which I, based on my conscious awareness of myself, my limited capacity to understand myself, where I decided I'm this and not something else, it becomes into a much deeper, realer, truer self, and therefore my ego, which I'm using words ego versus I, but this identity of myself is being utilized, it's empowering, it's a confidence of self, but a truer self, not a negative self, not a false self. And that's the process of Sphira. How we change, how we begin to view our true self, where is and who is our true self. And there's no greater indication of who we really are than in our emotions. Emotions have the secret. In our emotions lies the secret of our true being. Why is that? So there's a number of reasons for that. The first reason is because emotions come first. As a child born, the first thing that the person has is emotions. A child is all an emotional wreck. There's no logic there. A child doesn't go through a process of thinking. They don't have organized thoughts. It's one big raw emotion. And that is so innate and ingrained in the child that even after the brain starts developing and the cognitive mind starts working and there's a certain rationalization, it takes a long time for it to catch up. The emotions have already taken much more, it's much deeper, much more rooted in that sense. Another reason is that emotions are something that I could support myself within my environment. We all relate to emotions. If I'm feeling a certain hatred or a certain anger, I could see it in the real world. I could see the hatred in the real world. I could see the anger. I could see what I'm upset about. Logic relies on itself. I could come up with an idea, and it's something which is could be true or not. If someone disproves my logic, if someone disproves my way of thinking, so then I'll accept their way of thinking. It doesn't have that same support, that same reassurance as emotions have. And therefore, in a certain way, we trust more our emotions than we do with our logic. And a third reason why emotions are much stronger than logic, is because emotions, at the end of the day, are the root of man. We say, ki adam eitz asada, a person is a tree. And the Gemara compares a person to a tree and the fruit of a tree that you should. If a person is going to learn by someone, he should check out his tree. His tree represents tzemeach, growth. In Kabbalah and Chassidus, we relate to tzemeach, the idea of growth, to the idea of the emotions, the midas. The person's true roots, a person's true identity lies within his emotions. And the reason is because emotions are much firm, much more firm. They don't change. It's much harder to get a person to love someone he hates than to have a person change their logical conclusion about something. When it comes to logic, okay, you persuaded me logically that this makes more sense. I thought that atoms are one way, and you proved to me that atoms are a different way. Fine. But when it comes to emotions, and I have to now try to change whether I like this person or don't like this person, I should want to be connected to this person, not want to be connected to this person, that is a much more almost impossible process to do. And Chassidus is one of the objectives of Chassidus actually is to change the emotions. But even that itself, there's a lot of deep working in how that process takes place. But at any rate, what we see over here is that emotions, for a number of reasons, and there's more that we could talk about, but as everything that we'll mention probably could be spent a class on itself, each point in itself, but there's a number of reasons why we see emotions represent more the person. They're more of the identity of the person, a person who they love, who they hate, how they express themselves. Their relationship to others is usually a much deeper indication of themselves. And therefore, Sphira is primarily a time of focusing on our emotions. When we focus on our emotions, then we come in tune to our truer self, our true identity. And as I said, there's the transformation of this created self and coming to tune to our more essential self. Of all these emotions that we're talking about, of trying to get in tune with, and the classes that we're giving on is from Chesed to Yesod, even though Malchus is another one, is the seventh of the emotions. Whether it's an emotion or not is a matter of discussion. It's primarily referred to six emotions. But of all the emotions, the one that identifies the strongest of our character, of our nature, is the sphere of chesed. Now, I don't want to get into the whole discussion of the spheres and how they correlate to the human being and the idea of emotions from the Torah perspective and emotions from a psychological perspective. Do they correlate? Don't they correlate? That's a whole different discussion. But we all relate to the idea of chesed. We all know what chesed means. Chesed represents the truer, a true insight, a true window into our true self. That's what chesed represents. If we really want to get in tune with who we are, let's analyze how our life is governed by our midah, by our emotion of chesed. The reason is quite obvious, because what is chesed, as we'll see in a moment? The only way you could experience chesed is when you're sharing with others. And especially when you're sharing and having a relationship with your loved ones. If that's the true nature of chesed, so what greater indication of who I really am is only brought out when I'm sharing? It's only when I give myself off. It's only when I express myself. And the greatest midah of expression is chesed. Chesed represents the way the person brings out as much as he could, as we'll see in a moment, of himself, and therefore in chesed lies the true answer, or not the true answer. It gives a deep insight into who the person really is. So what are some basic characteristics of chesed? So I have written over here by B, we have chesed is giving, is extending, is attraction, it's love, it's the right hand. What does this all mean? So chesed, we understand, generally refers to this idea of a person giving. Chesed has this idea of the Eibishter, Kichofitz Chesed Hashem, the Eibishter created the world with Midas HaChesed. We know the idea of chesed represents the Eibishter giving, the idea of giving. What does the idea of giving mean? Why does a person give? Or what's the driving force of the person giving? So one of the driving forces of a person giving is this idea of extending oneself. In Kabbalah, we know that the letter, the name Chesed, the sphere of Chesed, correlates with the name Kael of God. The name Kael and Godel and Great. There are two different components in Chesed. One of the components is Godel, is godless, is greatness, extension of oneself. The ultimate objective of Chesed is to fully extend the person. The person wants to fully extend himself outside. He wants to be mespashet, as the words are in Chassidus. He wants to give himself off as much as possible. That's the nature of chesed. As a result, he gives. Because how do you expand yourself is when you give. The only way you're fully expanding who you are is by giving. That's the nature of chesed. But then there's another element of chesed, which is a much deeper element of chesed. And chesed over here doesn't necessarily mean just giving in the physical sense. Giving money to tzedakah, helping out a person that needs you to help them, taking care of their children or going to the store, whatever it is. But chesed has a much more deeper emotional, a more pnimi self, which is the power of attraction and love. Chesed means where the person wants to connect to something or to someone. That's the midah of chesed. Just like by extending, by giving someone money for tzedakah, by helping someone go to the store, driving them to work, whatever it is, it's a certain action of wanting to give from yourself into someone else. The nature, the deep element of chesed is this attraction of wanting to connect to something or to someone else. And that is expressed through being attracted to someone or something that the person feels they could connect with. Or they want the kid to connect with. And that results in love. So the pnimi, the inner element of chesed, represents love. That's what chesed represents. In the terms of Kabbalah, it's referred to the right hand. The right hand always represents this idea of the yamin mekarevis, the idea of the right hand embracing. It's the right hand is the one that extends. You extend usually your right hand. That means you're giving off to other people. You also bring in because you want to receive. You're trying to... The power of attraction makes you want to take as well. And that's usually the illusion of the idea of the right hand that's explained in Kabbalah. So this is the general understanding of what we're referring to by the midah of chesed. In short, we are dealing with a person, with people, the emotion to want to connect to others, to things, and wanting to make a connection to them on a very, very deep level. And that's usually what we call this idea of love, as we'll see more about it in a moment. The problem is that because it's such a deep, powerful tool, it comes with a very dark side as well. Like all tools we have in life, they could be used for something which is very good and very useful for us, or they could be used for a very, very to our detriment. They could be totally abused. And chesed is probably the most powerful, as we see already, that how powerful it is because it has that element of really bringing out a true essence of a person, as we'll talk about more a little bit later, that in that emotion lies a very great danger. If the emotion is used properly, it brings out the greatest of a person, it creates the greatest connection, the greatest love. If it's abused, it does the complete opposite. And just to give one simple illustration, and we're going to see more about this, the relationship between us and others, especially loved ones, the relationship between a father and a child, if the father used his power of love in a correct way, how that child is brought up and his relationship to his father and his relationship to the world versus if the father abuses his power of love. He uses it in a negative way. And the same thing is with a relationship between a husband and a wife. If the love is used in a positive way, it brings out the most deepest unifying power that there could be between the two, or it could be the greatest destruction between both peoples, and it brings out the worst in both of them. So we see how this power of chesed has this tremendous element. Now, what I want to do is, and I'm going to have to probably not spend a lot of time on everything here. I want to try to discuss from three different angles this element of chesed. I want to discuss it in our relationship between us and Hashem, because at the end of the day, the ultimate objective that we're dealing with is our relationship with Eibusher, with Kodesh Baruch Hu. How do we connect to Eibusher properly? What is the true midas ha-chesed? What is the true midas ha-ava? How do we express a proper love to God? And what are the struggles in that love to God? How does the love get sometimes destructive or dangerous? And then discuss it, how it applies between husband and wife, and likewise how it applies to children. Now, I may not get a chance to show the connection between every single thing that I'm talking about to all three, but I think that V'das L'Nov and Nakal, any person, any thinking person will be able to make sense of this themselves. If you take the papers later and just go over the points, I think it will be quite obvious how these things could connect every single person. So let us begin our discussion over here. There's a quote. I don't recall who the name of the person. This is one of the only quotes here that is taken from someone else. That really brings to light the beginning stages of our discussion. So I have the quote here by the Roman numerals, the number 4, that we used to love people and use things. Now we love things and use people. A very, very insightful and powerful line. And it really brings to light and it really brings to the discussion how we relate to love and what love really is. Is love a thing? Am I loving a thing? Or am I using a person? Or do I love a person and I use a thing? Is love the way I use love as a means to get something for myself? And therefore, I go with all means to even to the point as a user, transforming the user into an abuser because I want to get something. So then I look at the person as a thing. Or do I appreciate that there's a person here? And when I appreciate that there's a person here, there's a lot of, in that lies the true love. But from another whole perspective over here, it really begins to ask the question of what does it really mean, a relationship? What does it mean that I have a relationship with someone? naturally, every human being, regardless of how selfless they are, want to get something out of life. We're all subjective to want to get something out of life. And in relationships, even more so. Relationships, in a way, brings out within us as a urge to perfect ourselves. We're looking for perfection in ourselves, and a lot of times we see that perfection in our relationships. Whether it's that my wife or my husband has to be a certain way, or whether my child has to be a certain way, or my relationship to God has to be a certain way. I view a certain idea of perfection, and through that image of this urge to want to be perfect, I either impose or try to manipulate that I should be able to reach that level of perfection. You have people that when they get married, they have a view of how they want their home to be, and they thought they discussed this with their, you know, at the time, their fiancé or whatever it is, and comes reality, it's, you know, there's different people here. This person had this great ideal world built up in their mind, and it's just not working. There's a certain sense of wanting something, a certain sense of needing something, and this person is not giving it to me. And the drive, not necessarily is a bad drive. It doesn't come from a certain ego necessarily, or as we'll see later, a certain control, a certain unhealthiness, a certain psychological disorder. It comes from a very natural want to have things done the way you feel comfortable with. It's part of who we are. So how much of it is a bad thing? How much of it is a necessity in relationships? And how much of it actually destroys the relationship? In this sense of wanting something for ourselves, or seeing a perfect, or like take for example for the child. We see our children, or it's Hashem, but for those that have children, there's certain ways we want them to be brought up. We have an interest in trying to educate them. And we have ideas in our mind. And we're going to speak about the dangers of when you think you could control and manipulate your child. But what happens is that because you have this vision of perfection, or you try to make up all your mistakes as a younger person through your child, perfect yourself through your child, there could be a lot of danger in this type of relationship. So when we're asking the question, do I love people and use things, or do I use people and love things? There's a natural urge for every single person to want to use people, because the person could help me get to a state of perfection. But we're going to see, not necessarily, or to what extent, is the dangers involved in this particular situation. And really, we have to differentiate between a relationship between a father and a child, or a mother and a child. It's interesting, the Baal HaIkrim, the Sefer HaIkrim, Rabbi Yosef Albo, he wrote a Sefer HaIkrim, a famous Sefer HaIkrim. It's a book on philosophy, but in the book of philosophy, he discusses love. He discusses the idea of loving God. And Chelek Shlishi in chapters 36, 37, so he says that naturally a mother loves a child more than a father. And he says there's two crucial, he explains that there's three levels of love. And he says one level of love is a natural love. And he says a mother has more of a natural love to the child than a father, because there's two elements here. Number one, there is the very fact that it's part of who I am. The mother gives off part of her essence, which in that case, the father is the same way. But the mother also puts more effort into it. The 9 months of pregnancy, and even at a day-to-day level, a moment-to-moment basis, the child is being more taken care of more by the mother than the father. And therefore, he actually brings a raya from the Pasuk that says in Parshas Hazinu that that the Eibusher is our father and he made us. And because of that, our love, his love to us, is on a very, very deep level. At any rate, there's a very big difference between our relationship between a father, mother, and a child, and a husband and a wife. And for that matter, obviously, between us and God. For some reason, our feeling of attachment to our spouse does not necessarily have the same feeling. We're not on the same level of attachment as we are with our child. The pasuk describes the relationship between, you know, what we call biological family, relationship and family. The pasuk says when Esav meets up with Yaakov, he says that Atzmi b'sari ata, you're my flesh and blood. How could I do anything wrong against you? The pasuk wants to bring out that, you know, you can't do. He can't hurt your brother. You can't hurt your flesh and blood. When it comes to the story, though, with Adam and Chava, what does it say? Etzem me'atzomai. It's a bone from my bone. It's one of my bones. The relationship is somewhat different. We could excuse our children and forgive them for their not being perfect, but for some reason our spouse has to be perfect. I could understand why my child has a difficulty and not living up to my expectations, but with my wife, if they don't live, or my husband, if they don't live up with my expectations, therefore, this is the wrong person, I married the wrong person, why did I get into this to begin with, and so on and so forth. And our relationship with God, you're dealing with now with a whole different type of, do we see God? How could you have a relationship with something you don't even see? What are you relating to? We need something concrete. We need something real. So we have to realize that we're discussing three different types of relationships which are fundamentally different. And one of the things that I haven't really worked out yet, and this is something which I would appreciate anybody's feedback, is trying to understand this, how this plays out. On the one hand, we're supposed to love every single person, and we're supposed to love God on the same level, and then there's how do you love your wife versus love your child, and how does it all play together? But that's a different discussion, not something for now. But the point is that the relationships on these levels are very different. But in all these relationships, there are certain common or similar principles that apply in all of these cases. Now, we have to begin to understand a very important thing, that in all relationships, in all giving, in all love, giving by nature is receiving. Once I give, I automatically receive. And as we said before, is this nature of us wanting to get something, is that a bad thing or not? The fact that I want to get something out of a relationship, is that really a bad thing? I'm getting something anyway. I may not, you know, it may be that I want to get out of the relationship, that if, you know, my wife owns a lot of money, I want the money. But it could also be that I want to have a lot of love. I enjoy spending time with this person. I'm still getting something. So here there's a fundamental difference of understanding between giving in order to receive, in other words, the means of giving is for the ends of receiving. The end of the day, I want to get something. Versus the other way around. My receiving is the means to my giving. Because I get such a kick out of it. And I feel so connected to this person, that makes me want to give more. So in all the discussion that we're going to have here, and we're going to bring up a number of points of where we see that there is, so to speak, could be a problem within this wanting too much, or users versus lovers, users, abusers versus lovers, there's always an understanding that there is always a use here. There's always something we want or something we're getting out of it. The question is the perspective. Am I getting it? Is my objective to get something out of it on that level, or is my objective to want to give more? And through my fueling, my experience of giving, and my love that's being built through the giving, I therefore would like to give more and more and more. Another point, important distinction that has to be made here is between needs and wants. A lot of times we say, we need something. I need my wife to be more open. I need my child not to run around in shul. We create these boundaries in our minds, and we become convinced that they're essentials to our existence. And if my wife or my husband doesn't act in this particular way, or my child is not acting this particular way, and with God, if God doesn't, you know, I davened to God yesterday that he should give me to win the lottery. I didn't win the lottery today. So then I didn't get what I need. The relationship is over. There's a very big difference between saying I need something, or I want something, or I would like something. In other words, there's an appreciation of what's essential to my existence and what's nice. Today's day and age, we're very into romantic love, the feeling good, love by necessity, love because it works for us. Those are not focusing on essentials. Those are focusing on what I like in the sense of things that I decided based on my typhus. That's not what we're talking about over here. We're not talking about wants and likes in the sense of desires that we have. I want a beautiful wife. I want a beautiful home, and so on and so forth. We're talking about an appreciation of deep-rooted things. But even those things are only things I want, not something necessarily I need. And as we'll see, a few examples. But these are just two points to focus. That number one, all giving is receiving. The question is, what's the means and what's the ends? And number two, is it I need it, or do I want it, I like it? It makes me feel better. Certain people, for example, their way of communicating is through doing a lot of action. They don't talk about a lot. And the other party needs to discuss. They want to discuss it, right? So should we go on the trip next week? So one will just make the plans. We made a decision. The other one wants to have a whole discussion about it. So do you need to have the discussion about it? One person likes discussing ideas. The other person likes talking practically. Do you need to discuss the ideas? Or is it something that will give you a nice tickle? So what we have over here is that we have many different forms of how this could be expressed. And starting with a number of examples that we're going to show here, let us begin to maybe get a certain perspective of some of the issues, and therefore what will be the right perspective of what we're trying to accomplish. And by way of introduction, we have to separate between two groups over here. We're going to differentiate between natural relationships. I'm using the word natural here for a lack of better word. What I mean by a natural relationship, I'm talking about things which are instinctive by people. They're healthy instincts, very natural instincts, but could be dangerous or unhealthy or unhelpful in a relationship. And then there's a whole second group of things which are unnatural, unhealthy. A person has a problem. He may love or she may love very deeply, but they have a very negative psychological association with love. They don't understand how to use it. They love, but they don't know how to use it. And this natural versus unnatural, we could maybe break it down, the difference between a user versus an abuser. A usage is natural. Abuse is unnatural. The Rambam explains very, very beautifully in he writes an introduction, we're now learning Pirkei Avos, so he has 8 chapters of an introduction called the Shmeina Prokim LaRambam, that he has 8 chapters of introduction to his explanation to his commentary Pirkei Avos. So at the end, I think, of chapter 5, he explains the very interesting medrash that it says that a person shouldn't say, oh, what's the big deal that the Eibusher commanded me not to eat pork? I don't like it anyway. The Eibusher said that I shouldn't wear kilayim, mixed garments. It's not a big deal for me. Right? Efshi, it's okay, it's fine. Person has to say, really, I can't do it. I want it. I want to eat the pork. I want to have the bacon with eggs in the morning. I want to wear that nice woolen coat that has some nice lining of linen inside. Makes me feel comfortable. But what could I do that the Eibusher was geyser against it? And the Rambam makes a very, very important distinction. And he warns us. He says, don't make the mistake to think that this applies to even unhealthy natures. Taivas that we have, which are natural, like wanting to have a good piece of steak, there you need the Abishah to tell you, you want it, but override it. Things which are unhealthy. People have a certain unhealthiness that they like abusing people. An unhealthy nature, that is already something that you can't rationalize or excuse and say, okay, I want to do it, but God said I'm not, so therefore... No, you have to get help for that. You need to get treatment. You need to take care of that issue. So when we're going to break apart these two distinctions between the natural and the unnatural, the healthy unhealthy natural versus the unhealthy unnatural, there's a very big point in understanding. One is natural in the sense it's something which every person probably struggles with, and it's a healthy thing in the sense that we're normal. It's normal. The other one isn't. So what do we have over here? So we have over here on the list, the first one is I differentiate over here between two types of loves or two types of relationships. We have a very interesting Mishnah. We're talking about Pirkei Avos again. We have a very, very interesting Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, this is in Parakei, in a few weeks from now, the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, it's a famous Mishnah. It says that kol ava sheitluya bedover, batla dover, batla ava. Any conditional love, once the condition doesn't exist, the love doesn't exist. But if it's not conditional, it's never undone. The Mishnah gives examples. Azihi, what's considered a love, a relationship that's based on a condition, based on a thing, based on a dover? Zu avas, that's the love of Amin and Tamar. And what's considered an unconditional relationship? That's David and Yehoina's son. So let's just analyze these two examples for a moment. And I'm going to make this brief because otherwise we'll be here the whole night, just to give some basic understanding. What's the difference between the relationship between Amin and Tamar and the relationship between David and Yehoina's son? Amin and Tamar was a relationship based on a dover. It was a thing. He didn't love the person. He wanted to use the person because the person was a thing that you use. She was beautiful. Tamar was gorgeous. That's what the pasuk says. That his love to her was based on the fact, At Tamar achoisi ani oyev. Why? Because you're beautiful. As soon as he satisfied his taiva, not only did he not have any appreciation for her anymore, but he actually began to hate her. Because what happens when you satisfied what you want? Then all of a sudden you start seeing all the problems with the other person. Your focus has shifted. What am I doing in this relationship? What am I here for? I wanted to get something out of it. So either you got it, you got excited, you were dating this girl, or if it's a man, you were dating this guy, and he had all the qualities you were looking for. Which is a whole discussion for itself. People make lists or ideas of what they're looking for, but they have all the qualities you're looking for, and then all of a sudden you get married, and all of a sudden, you start seeing problems. Oh, the person has this issue and that issue. All of a sudden, you start focusing on the problems. And it becomes very hard to therefore say, one second, how did I get here? It's very hard to all of a sudden say that, it's very easy to say, how did I get here? What am I doing in this relationship? Amin and Tamar personify this idea of the love based strictly on a dover, on a thing. Amin saw Tamar as a thing. And unfortunately, the way it is in these type of relationships between husband and wife is that usually it's the male that uses the wife as a dover. Very dangerous. Versus David and Yehoina's son, there was no relationship based on anything. You know, I shouldn't really bring this up, but just on a side, the pasuk describes their love. The pasuk says that David HaMelech says to Yehoina's son, he says an expression, he says that G'dayla, he says a lashon, Nifla'asa avos chali ma'avas noshim. Your love to me is greater than love of women. in some people, obviously, you know, the more non-believers, thought this was some sort of a homosexual relationship between the two. And they compared it to, you know, Spartan and the Greek ideas of love, that the greatest love is between two males and all that. And obviously, it's an Issa Deiraisa. We're not talking about David HaMelech. David HaMelech, who's Melech, who's Mashiach comes from. To say, the Gemara says, whoever says David HaMelech sinned is Tosu. So obviously, we can't be talking about such a grievous sin as that. But it's obvious what we're talking about. We're talking about a love that's not contingent. There's no greater indication of a love that's not contingent on anything than if there is nothing to which to be based on. What are you loving the other person for? You're not getting anything out of the other person per se. What was the love between David and Yainasan? And furthermore, Yainasan Shaul told Yainasan, you're not even getting the malucha. You're not going to get this. I'm going to completely write you off if you still love David. And yet he still loved David. Because the relationship was not based on a dover. It wasn't based on what am I getting out of it. There was a certain appreciation of an essential bond, of an intrinsic connection that goes beyond any dover. Something which is seen only from a perspective when we transcend the differences between ourselves. Where it's not about that I like the color red and you like the color blue. But there's a certain intuitive, deeper sense of unity, of sharing an essence that allows us to penetrate much deeper within ourselves, to connect to something which is not about anything, that which is not about getting something back. And there's much more we could analyze about this relationship between the two. But interesting, the next Mishnah right away says, what's the very next example? Any argument that's for the sake of heaven, eventually you'll survive. If it's not l'shem shemayim, ain seif l'skayim, it won't survive. What's the connection between these two mishnayos over here? So the Maral wrote a pirush on the mishnayos on Pirkei Avos called Derech HaChaim, and he says, because what is the essential reason that two people could argue and yet still be in love with each other? Because it's not about a dover. If you have an avashena tuluya bedover, then you could have a machloikas l'shem shemayim. Then your love is no more based on the differences that we have for each other. You see sometimes parents argue with their children, or spouses argue with each other. They may disagree, fine, we're human beings. We have different minds. Ain day and say in Shavuos, we don't agree to everything. Doesn't mean that therefore I'll turn away from the conversation and saying this person is disgusting to me. How did I ever even want to have a relationship with this person? Because the relationship was never based on this dover. It was based on a einot tluya bedover. On nothing which is within my physical understanding. It's an intuitive pull. It's an attachment that's much deeper. And therefore, the Mishnah says that Soifel is Kayim, because that type of argument is not an argument that breaks someone, it's an argument that actually brings up people together even deeper. When we could share our differences, it actually enables us to have a deeper connection, as we'll see in a moment. So what do we have over here? So on our paper, page 1, we have towards the end, we have behavior in relationships, we have natural, we have conditional. So in A, in 1A, the question is, what do I need? What makes me happy? The first perspective in the conditional love is all the self. It's all about my ego, what I want, how I want to get out of it. And I give some examples. Love of self. Every person loves themselves. But here, the love of self is that I need to get what I want out of this relationship. Infatuation. I get very excited about the person. Lust, self-perfection, a trophy, pleasurable drugs. Some people get a kick out of love. It's a drug for them. Physical love or emotional love is a certain drug for them. So that's what they want out of the relationship. Someone to care for, someone that cares for me. You're comparing one to another. These are all elements of where you're getting something out of it. And there's many more. And unfortunately, like I said before, this doesn't just apply between a husband and a wife. This applies to a father and a child. You see the child, and what do you want out of the child? I want the child to be perfect. I want my child to be a trophy. Look, I can show him off. If he doesn't, you know, if he's not the smartest kid in the class, I'll beat him up. Rahman al-Islam. I have a child that's going to take care of me when I get older. There's many examples like that. And in our relationship with God, it's very easy. How many times do we say, we daven, I want to win the lottery? Your relationship is all based conditional. My love to God is based on I know that he can give me what I want. Or, I want to be perfect. I know my sense of perfection is when I daven to the Eibishter and I learn and I do all the Eibishter's mitzvahs. It's a higher level, but it's still a selfish level. It's still what I get out of it. It's what I need. The ideas of God blow me my mind. And again, we could discuss many examples, but the time doesn't allow us to go through everything over here. But this is some basic understanding of where the love is starting off. The basis of the love is beginning, its beginning stages is based on what I want. And as soon as I don't get that, what's the results? So we have over here the results. Blame. You start blaming the other person right away. It's your fault. You start finding fault with the other person. Dissatisfaction. Rejection. He is not for me. You start focusing on imperfections. And you start acting without any feelings. You feel completely disconnected. God didn't give me $1 million. So now, what am I davening to him for? My child didn't pass the test. Okay, I have to bring him to the house because, you know, I'm not going to throw him out. I'm not that cruel, but like, I'm not going to have much of an association. My wife, you know, is not giving me, you know, the supper I want. You know, use stupid examples, but unfortunately, these stupid examples play a role in our life. Or I wanted my wife to be more of a, you know, more of a Shomer Shabbos than she is, and therefore I reject her. The sense of rejection, the sense of not wanting, is because the whole focus to begin with was based on what am I getting out of this relationship. Versus unconditional love, we have on page 2, is what does my partner need? What makes my partner happy? You're appreciating your partner as an individual, not about me, but we, seeking unity, self-extension. You see the other person as a person. It's not a thing. I'm not using a thing. I'm loving a person. You begin to appreciate that despite the fact that you want something in this relationship, which every person wants, there's another person that wants something also. There are two minds here, two individuals. If you have this perspective, so then the result's a satisfaction. You could feel a certain sense of satisfaction in the relationship. Because again, if I'm giving the whole time and I feel that I'm making my other happy, I'm making my child happy, I'm making my wife happy, I'm making my husband happy, I'm serving God and making God happy, there's satisfaction. Because that's my goal, that's my objective. There's acceptance of the person. Okay, so they're not the smartest person. They're not the most beautiful. They're not the most creative. They don't make the greatest child. I don't know. Patience. You allow them to talk. You allow them to express. You allow them to be a person. You have patience with them. They're not a thing that you say if you don't work. It's like today, if the internet doesn't work, you start smashing the computer. That's a thing. That's not a human being. There's no patience with things. Unity, you're trying to bond, you're trying to connect, and therefore something you realize you have to remove all these other obstacles in the way. Focus on essentials, and your actions are motivated. You get energized by your actions. And as we said before, the ultimate is where the receiving that you get from your actions actually is the fuel to give more. So now, if we're dealing with this type of situation, one that has the conditional love, one, that's their relationship. And like I said before, this is instinct. Most people fall under the category of conditional love. Unfortunately, that's the way it is. Not necessarily on the most egotistical, selfish level, but there's something that they want. And if they don't get it, it could hurt. You could be in a relationship and you could really love the person, but sometimes, you know, the person makes a comment or you thought the person will do you something and they didn't, and all of a sudden you get angry. It's natural. And if the tear doesn't get fixed up right away, that tear could grow bigger and bigger and bigger. You could have people that loved each other for 50 years, and then a small little rift kicks in, and the ego then kicks in, it becomes selfish, and as a result, there's a whole breakup over here. So what are some general perspectives that maybe we could have in this type of thing? So first of all, as we said before, there's one important essential difference. It's not what I need, it's what I want. The things that I'm looking for in a marriage is not about, or my child, or my connection to God. It's not what I decided I need. There may be nice things, but it's not what I need. It's things that may help me, you know. For example, a person, let's say, could appreciate that if they're very tired at the end of a day, you know, and they want to just relax, so they may feel that they want to just be able to sit back and, I don't know, watch the news. They don't want to be bothered with the children. So one person will appreciate, besides the fact that my wife spent the whole day with my children, or my children didn't see me the whole day and they want to interact with me, and so on and so forth, they'll appreciate, okay, I'm exhausted, I understand. Maybe we'll try to do as much as I could, and then maybe I'll be able to. But another person becomes with a resentment. Don't you appreciate what I did today? I worked like a dog to make you money, keep bringing money into the house. What's the difference between the two of them? Why does one go to that anger and the other one doesn't? And we all do this, by the way. Even if we're on the most, you know, evil-killed person, we still go to that extreme sometimes. But what is the driving force behind it, besides the fact that we're human beings? It's because we stop thinking about what we would like and what makes things easier for us, and we use those needy things, the things that we think we need to have. I need to relax right now. And we become selfish, and we become the ego. So some perspectives over here. Again, this is my ideas, but I think it's could be very helpful. Relationships are not about matches on a paper. It's not what matches up on a piece of paper. I should have put that word better. It's not about what matches up on a piece of paper. In other words, a lot of times you see, well, this person has these qualities, I have these qualities. Once you're married, that goes out the window. Maybe when you're dating and you have to decide whether this person you could feel comfortable with, so you start deciding, you know, matching, do they have the personality that I like, am I going to talk to them? Once you're married, the marriage already, there's an acceptance that there's something greater here than just the individual details, so to speak. Now, we have to obviously appreciate that there are times that a marriage is not for me, but that's a different, those cases, I think, we're very much dealing with an essential problem, not a, you know, peripheral detail issue. We're dealing with a much more greater essential problem. Relationships are not static. They are always works in progress. Don't think when you get married, don't think when you have a child, don't think when you're going to start davening, all of a sudden, you're going to feel connected. All of a sudden, I'm going to have this greatest love life in the world. I'm going to feel so attached to my child. You know, the child is being born. I'm all getting excited. This is going to be the greatest thing in the world. I'm going to love him or her. You might meet this girl. The girl meets the guy. They get all excited. You're about shuvah. That gets in tune with Abish. And all of a sudden, life should be easy. Everything should go well. Everything is beautiful. That's not the way relationships work. That's not the way love works. Love is a constant progress, a development from stage, from A to B to C. It's the fights that go with it, as we'll see in a moment. Reaching unity is appreciating the process of the merging of two individuals into a single unit. Marriage is a journey. Relationship is a journey. And here I'm talking about specifically between husband and wife and between peoples that we don't naturally connect with, at least not biologically. There's a lot of times there's a certain focus in relationships that I got married to this person, all of a sudden we should just like match, we should just work together as a team. We don't realize, the Gemara says, but the Gemara identifies that it's not an easy match. You have two different personalities. You're talking about people that had at least 20 years before, 18 years before, a whole life to themselves. All of a sudden, they're coming into your life, and vice versa. It doesn't just all of a sudden match. It doesn't work. You know, it's like the tectonic plates, you know, when there's two mergings of two of the plates, there's a big, you know, could be an eruption, there could be a volcano, there could be an earthquake. You have to merge a new plate together. When you're trying to merge two different personalities into a single personality, it takes work. And sometimes that work could be volcanic. It could be eruptive. And there's an expectation for that. Don't think you're going to get married and the first 5 months or the first 2 months, you're all excited. All of a sudden, life hits. And all of a sudden, who did I marry? Why did I get married? Or 10 years down the road, it hits. Whenever the point of when you have to merge these two personalities kick in, it's always going to be difficult. And the power of unity is through diversity. The only way that a person really could appreciate another and really unify with another is not where they're similar. No one likes speaking to themselves. If my child is going to be exactly like me, I probably have a hard time creating a unifying relationship. And if my wife is exactly like me, I'll have that issue. And in general, unity is only brought out through diversity. Harmony is brought about through diversity. Beauty is diversity. It's taking two opposites and bringing them together. It's seeing the difference between two things as we're bringing them together. You take two colors and you merge them together. There's something beautiful. It's not when you want to eradicate one color. And I'm moving fast because I don't want to stay here the whole night. I don't think you either want to. True love comes about through pain and struggle. And I write over here the honeybee analogy. What do I mean by this? A honeybee. You ever try to get the honey out of the honeybee comb? The honeycomb? They come and attack, right? They're coming and attack you, but you're going still forward. You know the only way you're going to get that honey is through the sting. Love is the same way. It's impossible to get love without being stung. Part of the reason is because you love so much, so automatically a person you care for so much, you're destined to be stung by that person. But on a basic level, the very nature of going through a process of loving someone means that there are steps along the way that there are going to be these stings, these bites. It's not something that just comes natural. There's no purpose on a desert island. This is for the egotist. I'm here. I want to get everything. So then, what's my purpose in life? My purpose in life is just for myself. It's all about my selfish being. So let me go on a desert island and live my life the way I want. I can get everything I want. But you understand and appreciate that you can have no purpose on a desert island. You need other people. Why do you need other people? Because they're different. You understand the difference of the other person and what they had enable you to do. You appreciate that the only way you're actually happy is because they're different. And this is another very important point in a relationship. A lot of times you feel satisfied, you're happy. You don't even realize that you're happy because you're married to the right person. Or you're happy because you have the children who you have. You don't even appreciate that the reason is because your children are so deeply attached to you. And then, because you're selfish, you begin to think, why is it today that I'm down? I don't want my wife to nag me. I don't want my child to bother me. And you throw away the very thing that's actually giving you that sense of peace of mind. Or you reject the very thing that's actually allowing you to be generally in a happy state of mind. The last point I have is I didn't choose, I was chosen. There's another mistake. People think that when they get married, they made a choice. If I made a choice, you know, I would like to back out on the deal. I went to the store, I bought a computer, I thought I liked it, I don't like it anymore, let me back out. That's not what happened over here. There's a certain natural process. We believe God has something ordained for us. This is my other half. And again, we're talking about cases where it's not really an issue on the level that they're not supposed to be the right match. But in most cases where we're talking about they are the right match, just you have these egos getting in the way. When I start thinking, oh, I chose so I could undo my choice. So first of all, you were chosen, and that should give a certain sense of love. The other person also chose you. But more than that, deeper than that, the point over here is that if I look at it, that God had a plan here. God put me in this world to do something. God had an vision of who I'm supposed to marry. God put us two together for a purpose. If I believe that God has a purpose for me, I don't always appreciate, you know, you're born into a family that your father, you know, was abusive. Are you going to reject your father? It's very difficult. Ask any child that went through an abusive, they defend their father in most cases. And the reason is because it's not something that you chose that you could throw away. You're too connected. And here, between a husband and wife, there could be sometimes an element where you think you did choose. Between us and God, there's sometimes, I chose to be religious, or my parents made me be religious. So why do I have to be religious now? You can't fight with nature. You can work with nature. This is natural. When you fight it, you usually fall short. Some tips. Go back to the honeymoon. Whenever we get into these struggles between dissatisfaction, not happy, wanting to, you know, why did I marry this person? My child is not, you know. There's always a moment that we could go back into our minds of where we actually appreciated a certain love. There's experiences that we had with this person that was tremendous, where we felt the love, a tremendous deep love. For some in marriage, it's the honeymoon period. We just got married. You're on top of the world. It's like in the month of Elul, we have the Ani L'doidi V'doidi Li. Elul's the Melech Basodach, so to say, the king is in the field. We're reliving the honeymoon. He shows us the love and the care that we always had. We're reliving that experience. There's an essential part in marriage and in a relationship with children or children to their parents is to remember those experiences, those past experiences that may have been maybe years ago, but they were positive. And not just positive, they left a very deep mark in our minds. We could reconnect to those moments that fuels us to go further. And we find this in Judaism a lot, besides Elul. One of the mitzvahs of Zechiras Yetzias Mitzrayim is because when we remember what God did for us, it enables us to constantly fuel our love towards God. But like I'm saying, there's so much here we could talk. I'm just going to move forward. Don't just feel expressed. Now, this is a very, very important thing in relationship. A lot of times you feel like you love the person. You actually, in your mind, the whole relationship's in your mind. You never tell the person, I love you. You never actually express anything in the relationship. It's cold. You can even do a lot of actions for the person, but you never verbalize. The other person wants to hear that they're loved. Especially when they feel vulnerable that they gave up their whole life for you. With your child, when you don't tell your child that you love them, they may know it. There's a very big difference when you say the words, I love you. And there's many psychological reasons why people have difficulties with saying those words. But the point is that there's no greater power than creating a relationship, sustaining a relationship, affirming a relationship with the expression that goes with it. And we find it by God. There's a pasuk in Malachi. God says, "Ahavtem eschem amar Hashem." God says, "I love you." Throughout all the stories in Tanakh, there's always at some line, at some point, God says, "I love you." So, Chati lo chesed nuraych aves kulusayach. Because God, a lot of times there's difficulties in the relationship. That's normal. Don't expect, like we said before, it's honeybee. Don't expect it to be all beautiful. But when there's a constant saying I love you, when there's a constant expression, and we know what the power of expression does, it actually makes us feel more deeply loved. More love is brought out when we say the words and we just think it in our minds. Think about your loved ones. This is part of this idea that people sometimes neglect, the idea of thinking about their loved ones. You know, you have 10 children, you come home from work, you want to do your own thing. When was the last time you thought about your child? About where they're holding in life, what are they doing? When was the last time you actually considered how your relationship with your wife is? When was the last time you thought about your relationship with God? Just thinking about it, Chassidus talks about his bonanus, just becoming aware of your other, aware of your loved, your beloved, the one that you loved, your friends, your children, your wife, your husband, your spouse, God. Just thinking about it triggers a love. It brings back, it's part of the same process of the honeymoon experience. So what we're seeing over here is that these are usually generally understandings that go together in general relationships. I just want to add one more thing that I didn't put here, and this is a general rule for the whole thing, and that is that love does not mean having an emotional stimulation. People make mistakes. I don't love her anymore. I don't love my child I don't love God. That's not what love is about. That's not relationship. That's not what a relationship is about. Relationship is not about an emotion. A relationship is about a certain attitude that we have. It's a certain awareness of my purpose in life, of a realization of who I am and what I'm doing. For me, I'll give a personal experience. So for many years, I was in a school till I got married in Pennsylvania, and I wasn't very excited about doing what I was doing. And at times, it could be very difficult. You want to leave, you want to get out of this, you don't want to have anything to do with it, and so on and so forth. And I wasn't feeling stimulated. I wasn't getting what we call sipukha nefesh. But then what was enabled me to get out of that state was saying, but I believe in this. I know this is the right thing. And as we're going to see, we'll get to it quickly at the end, one of the core essential points in love is trust. Part of trust is trusting that you made the right choice, not second-guessing yourself. And obviously trusting that your children are actually going to turn out the way they're supposed to. But a lot of the time is that we think we need to feel a certain something, and if we're not feeling that something, there's something wrong with us. There's love, there's something missing here. And a lot of times it's based on that selfish sense of what we want in marriage. It's not really looking at what marriage really is. It's that unity that's being created. Or in children, it's not about what I want out of my child or my child is getting out of me. It's a certain connection, that essential connection that runs much deeper. And therefore, I may not be... Love is not a consistent, honeymoon. There may be times that I'm tacking a state of down. I'm not happy with what's going on. But what pushes me to go forward is by realizing that this is life. This is what I want. This is, at the end of the day, much deeper. It runs deeper than any of the above of all the wants and things like that. Just to run quickly now between the unnatural, unhealthy power of influence. Now, here we're talking about, like we said before, people that do really love, but they have a psychological disconnection with love. They don't understand how to utilize it properly. They're utilizing it, but in a very wrong way. One of them is a person who's controlling. You have a controlling parent, a controlling partner, a controlling spouse. They're manipulative. They lack trust in other people. They feel inadequate, so therefore they use other people in order to build their own self-esteem. Then they can't control themselves, so they have to control other people. They need things to be done their way. And I give an example here, like religious practices. You have certain people that part of their controlling nature is that, you know, they were brought up that, you know, on Pesach we don't eat X, Y, and Z, so they're going to forcefully make their spouse or their children do it that way. That's a controlling, unhealthy element. That's an abuser. That's not love. It may come from a point of love because you really want them. You care about them. You want them to do the right thing. I'm telling you, Shulchan Aruch says this is what you have to do. And religion, a lot of times, is where this element of control becomes to be a major problem in relationships. A lot of abuse goes on with religion. I'm not trying to knock religion out, but it's a very important element to realize that the dangers associated with not appreciating the difference between wanting to have a positive influence on a person versus a negative influence on a person. Now, control is different than controlling. There's a necessity for us. Having control is a healthy thing. It gives us reassurance that we matter. It gives us a power over our emotions. It allows us to make the outcomes come out the way we want. Controlling is where you completely suppress the other person. Do not allow the other person to think. Do not give the other person space. Squash them. I need to get what I want. I have a certain belief. It has to happen my way. Or I have an inadequate feeling of my self-esteem. So to boost my self-esteem, it's like the inferiority complex. This child in school is going to be the bully to knock down the best boy in the class because he needs to build himself up. That's part of the bullying controlling element that's here. Fear of losing control. A lot of controlling happens when you just became very in tune with religious ideas. You became a Baal Tshuva. Or you have a certain perspective on life. Or you just became, you know, very in tune with dieting and exercise. So you feel that if you're going to let go and you're not going to impose it on your family, you're automatically losing control over yourself. You know, certain people, it's like an OCD. You get very anxious about your ideas, your routine. You need to have a certain routine in life. And if the routine doesn't work, so then you feel like you you know, you lost control. Especially if you felt you gained control. Like, let's say a person who was an addict, and all of a sudden they were able to get off it, there's a fear, there's a hesitation that they're going to lose it, they're going to go back to the substance. Very unhealthy element. And in religion, this plays a major role, not just between, you know, children and parents and husband and wife, but between you and God. You have a fear, you don't want to do an aver. Why? I'm afraid that God is not going to give me food tomorrow. You know, till now, you know, you build up this whole idea that the reason why God was giving me whatever I needed because, you know, I davened every day, and if I don't, so therefore God is going to kill me. A very unhealthy relationship to God, where you see God as a controlling factor in your life. And I'm really rushing through this. Results is aggression. Obviously, you try to force yourself, you get angry on them, you get paranoid, verbal abuse, making loved ones feel unworthy, you squash them, you make them feel small or silly, you have lack of patience. What's the mindset and the causes? Fear of unhappiness. You really think that the only way you're going to get yourself happy is if you're in control. You don't trust anybody to give you the sense of happiness you want. Life is unpredictable unless I control it. The only way to ensure my happiness is to exercise power over or manipulate others. You became so attuned to being able to get what you want only through manipulating and controlling others that you just don't appreciate that love means not that. You don't begin to appreciate that. And I write, what could be some causes? Childhood abuse and domination, deprived of basic wants or needs, problem with those who grow up during famine, the Great Depression, or in home with financial struggles, etc. These are classic signs of people that have love, want to express the love, they just don't know how to. Another one is codependency, relinquishing control. You don't give any, you completely gave yourself up control. You see control as a bad thing, which is a problem, not feeling worthy, you don't feel you could express yourself, fear of rejection, abandonment. Basically, you're walking on eggshells the whole time, need for love. You go down the list, results of this, it's withdrawal, passive aggression, the way you relate to your partner, to your children, is that you run away from them, you don't express your love to them, or your child feels this way. Your child feels you're so dominating on them that they lose any sense of worthiness that they can't open up their mouth to you. So therefore, they just run away, they need to withdraw, they need to hide, they withhold information, they don't want to tell you what they're feeling. So your wife, your husband, your child won't express themselves to you because of it. There's a feeling of trapped, where I can't do anything anymore in life, lack of independent identity. Mindset, power, and love can't coexist. You have a certain idea in your mind that in order for me to be loved, in order for me to love, someone needs to dominate me. You became so ingrained that domination is the only way love works. So either you're the one that's dominating or you're being dominated. Love means submission, which is basically the same point, but it's different in the sense that you think that the only way that you'll be loved is through being submissive. I need to please in order to be loved. This is a very big problem you find by people that were tremendously traumatized as children, is that the only way they could feel that they'll be accepted is if they get acknowledgement from other people. Lack of encouragement to be assertive. These are some causes. Autonomous and education. Problems sometimes among women growing up in religious homes, that sometimes the religious ideas of the child, the girls and the women don't have any right to say what they want. They can't express themselves. They get shut up. You don't understand anything. You don't know anything. You're an Amma Aretz and all those things. Not given positive reinforcement and acknowledgement at home or in school. And this is especially very important with children. When they're not constantly reassured that their parents not just love them, but appreciate who they are regardless, it instills within them that the only way that they could be loved is when they submit, when they're not acknowledged for anything. Love and power do not coexist. A third problem over here is too attached. This is a whole different set of problems. Constant reassurance of parents' love, of partner's love. The child or the father, the husband or the wife constantly need to feel that they're being loved. With our relationship with God, if we don't feel God is loving me, all of a sudden, you know, sometimes you get, you know, you trip out on God, you feel God is loving you. Then all of a sudden you wake up the next day not on the right side of the bed, all of a sudden God doesn't love you. But deeper yet, within a relationship, within your loved ones, there's a constantly reassurance, yes, I love you, yes, I love you. Feeling insecure in relationships, you constantly think that any moment things could go haywire. Not giving loved ones, we're holding on page 4, not giving loved ones space, automatically what happens is that you therefore need your parent, you're always needing your partner, you don't allow them to exist for themselves, you constantly squash any opportunity where they could be free. Results are impulsive behavior, a lot of this is borderline personality, self-harm, they afflict harm to get attention, physical abuse, substance abuse, mood swings, manipulation. The mindset is intense fear of rejection and abandonment. They're literally terrified that the people are not going to love them. And therefore, the only way they feel they could love is by squashing out of the person that the person is never going to leave them. Some people love too much that they feel that the only way they can live is if they kill the person. There's another unhealthy state, a very ridiculous, very, very extreme cases of this type of situation, childhood abuse or neglect. Okay, perspectives. We'll finish off with this. We are one essence in two different bodies. What we got out of this whole thing is an appreciation that at the end of the day, we have to appreciate that however much we're connected, I cannot control my other. I don't allow myself to be controlled. I have to appreciate that we need independence. Independence is part of the growth of a relationship. Why? Because when I could choose that I love, my love is much deeper. When I'm forced to love, then the love is not real. That's one of the problems people have with religion. I was never brought up to love God. I never came from me. It wasn't freedom of choice. And the same thing is within a relationship with a child and parents specifically, where they never felt that they were given a chance to choose, right? And therefore, the relationship could go bad in that sense. There's an important point to realize that there are two different bodies. We may be one essence. We may be unified, but there are two different people here. And the two different people need to have that difference. They need to retain that identity difference. Love breeds healthy sense of power and independence. If you have true love, you allow the other to exist, and therefore you exist. You don't squash them, they don't squash you. It's not a problem to feel independent in a relationship. It's a necessity to feel independent. Obviously not independent that you want to run away. That's not what we mean by independent over here. What we mean over here is that you feel the need to give the space, as we're going to see in a moment. I don't lose my identity by loving. I gain a true identity. The only control I have is the knowledge that I am not in control. People who struggle with control, one of the main anxieties is that they constantly have to think, you know, I'm losing control. So they're constantly thinking about what they're thinking they're losing control. They have to let go. They have to appreciate the only control they have is what they're not in control, that they're not in control. True love is making space for others. When you love someone truly, so then you you allow the person to exist and independently. And as like we said, you see this by God. The Eibishter gave us Bechira Chofshis. But the Eibishter also has Achdus, Hashkocha Pratus. Everything is manipulated by God. So we're in a relationship. We're constantly there. Behold, everything we do, we got to do for God. But God also gave us the choice. And that choice is crucial in the relationship. When we have the freedom of choice, it becomes from us. When you have a child that you want the child to do what you think is the right thing for them, if you don't give them the choice, that's squashing them. That's breaking them. That's not letting them grow. This is something we'll talk about next week. But the point is, it's what destroys them. Tips, get help, seek professional guidance. And over here, what I mean is appreciating that there's a problem and go to help that you could get. Work on developing self-esteem and independence. A person needs to appreciate that love is not about constant reassurance. If you have a healthy self-esteem, a healthy self-confidence, you could appreciate that the person could have their space and so on and so forth, and you don't have to control them. Allow yourself to be vulnerable. This is another important point. A lot of times in relationships, people have this fear to be open. They're afraid to be open. They don't know what's going to happen. They don't feel secure, whether it's a child, a parent, you to God, husband and wife, and so on and so forth. There's a certain, it's a lack of surrender. You don't want to get too close because you're afraid you may be rejected. And that vulnerability is an essential part in relationships because that's what gets us deeper. When we still have walls that we don't allow ourselves to break further, so then we never actually bond properly. Learn how to share control. This is especially important in husband and wife. The Gemara says in Bar Mitzvah, let the wife take care of the financials and you take care of the spiritual things. In other words, appreciate that you both have two different roles in life. That the famous story of either was whoever exactly it was said about, Rabbi Sol Salanter, that they made an agreement when they got married that the woman, will take care of all the Gashmias and Rabbi Sol will take care of all the Ruchnias, and for the rest of their life they fought over what was considered Ruchnias and what was considered Gashmias. Don't be afraid of openness. Now, this is a different point than vulnerability. Allow your spouse, your child, to speak to you. This is something that the Eibishter does out of his love. It's called Yom Kippur. He allows us to talk to him, to be open, to discuss our problems, to say, yes, we sinned. We're normal. We're human beings. We have problems. When you squash the opportunity for your child to open up, you automatically squash their whole existence. If you don't give the room to space for your spouse to open up to you, you automatically take away their whole identity and existence. Conclusion. True love and happiness and healthy relationships is predicated on three essentials. Love. And what we mean here, love, is like we're saying, love is not this romantic feeling of exciting, you know, things. Love is a purpose. It's an understanding deeper. There's a relationship being built on a much deeper level. Respect. You have to appreciate that you can't trample on the other person. A lot of times in a relationship, you think, this is my part. This is me. My child is me or my wife. It's etzem atzama. I can do whatever I want. You have to have the respect and you have to have the trust, as we said before, that you made the right decision. Everything is going to turn out the way you're going to be. And especially with people who have this, we said before, this controlling problem. Part of it is they don't trust. They don't think that, you know, the other person could really help them in life. The objective is to transcend our physical, egotistical beings, strive to the essential. Over here, this means is that you have to create for yourself sometimes examples of this. A lot of times when you can see that you have a child, you see your child, that itself is an indication of a unity. You have to see how you bond together, especially husband and wife. You do things together. You make something together. When you focus on that unity and you focus mainly on where we connect, that allows there to be a very loving and caring relationship. True love results in absolute unity. The point being over here is that we all have our natural instincts in marriage, in any relationship we have. We have a tremendous capacity to love, to have chesed, to give. The question just is, are we using it or abusing it? Are we loving or using? Or using or abusing? Are we aware of what is the shortcomings of love? What is the strong points of love? Don't get confused between created sense of love and what true love is. And the objective, obviously, is that we're not trying to get ourselves into a better state. The Rambam says, when it comes to serving the Eibishter, the highest level of serving the Eibishter, we find by Avraham Avinu that he did what the Eibishter wanted. Why? Not to get anything. Because Kivin Shu Emes, that's the truth. He sacrificed Yitzchak on the Akedah. He could have told God, what are you, crazy? I'm going to sacrifice my son. But to him, his love to God was not based on what he's getting out of it. At the end of the day, love, true connection, is not about what I get. It's not a physical or emotional or intellectual stimulation. It's something I identify as true. This person is mine, is me. I identify a truth of whether I see it in child or whatever it is. I identify a truth of my existence in this person. And when I reach that point, all the bodies, all the different details between us and the person are not an issue anymore. And the ultimate thing, says the Rambam, eventually what you have is that if you truly live on that level, then you have the truest joy and the truest delight and pleasure in that relationship. We should be zeicha that we should, it says when Mashiach comes, that we're going to be able to have the Ava B'Tanugim, this true experience of love with Eibishter. So we should have a take from Yad Mamash.
Thank you very much, everyone. Hope to see you back next week, Tuesday night, at the class on Gevura. Thank you again. Everyone, a good week. Yes, we can make the minyan now.